The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Film Show, where we're stopping the clocks and cutting the telephone and wailing at the heavens. It's the week in which Michael Haneke plays Grim Reaper on the award-winning Amour, but that's not all. I know that's not all, because this is also the week in which the Twilight film franchise ups and dies. It's like two hammer blows to the heart falling one after the other. Bowing out on the show this week, Emmanuel Riva eases towards the exit door on Michael Haneke's Amour. A middle-class Australian family go what the psychiatrists refer to as purely barking bonkers in PJ Hogan's Mental, and musician Jason Becker provides a little ray of hope in the documentary Not Dead Yet. But let's begin at the end, as Stephanie Meyer's tale of vampire lovers, undead armies, and buff werewolf boys reaches its final chapter. It's Twilight, Breaking Dawn, Part 2.
After 18 years of being utterly ordinary, I finally found that I could shine.
It's farewell to Edward and Bella, the vampire sweethearts who felt the need and did the deed. It's goodbye to Jacob Black, the topless little wolf boy, and it's even sayonara to the evil Volturi clan, still intent on spoiling the party. It's the Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn, Part 2, and we shall never see its like again.
Joining me now is The Guardian's very own Bella and Edward. It's Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw and the film site editor Andrew Pulver. Peter, I seem to remember your review of the very first Twilight movie years and years ago.
Yes.
In which you kind of raved about it.
I did. It's incredible to think now, but that first movie, and in my innocence and naivety, I didn't quite grasp that it was a saga that was going to go on almost literally forever. But the sheer novelty of it struck me. And it's a very good story. Without all the kind of trappings that with which it has subsequently been invested, it's actually really good. Catherine Hardwicke did this great job. It looked fascinating. All the stuff about abstinence and sexuality and the way teens are sexualized, it seemed to have a lot of interesting, un-cliched stuff to say about it. And yes, it was good. It was a really good film.
I'm sensing a but coming up.
But there's a massive... Well, the but is provided by the franchise itself. But there were loads and loads of other films like that, entirely without its narrative interest, descending, unravelling into this kind of biblical Tolkien last battle, which all sagas and franchises have to go in for in the end. And it just, for me, it really kind of deteriorated. And there was no, I don't know, there are flashes of fun and flashes of wit in this last movie, definitely. But all the stuff in the first movie about her pals, her mates, the kind of losers and the dorks that she hung around with, there was lots of fun like that in the first movie. And there's nothing like that now. Yeah. There are just these vampires who look like robots from Westworld. You know that sci-fi movie? They all look like that. They've all got these contact lenses and they all look like automatons. And they all have this kind of wooden, not really wooden, but more specifically metallic acting style. And I'm afraid I've been trying to work myself up into a kind of lenient sort of let's give it a break for the last time, but I can't do it. I feel undead thinking about it, I'm sorry to say.
Andrew, there has been a progression though, without wanting to spoil it for all the millions of fans. Bella is now a vampire lady with a little daughter.
Absolutely. I mean, this is what this concluding part is about. It's about sort of vampire nuclear family and how they sort of cope and defend their kid from the Volturi, I think they're called. I mean, but in general, I mean, I kind of have to agree with Peter that, you know, the whole thing is so ploddingly serious and laborious. It is like watching a sort of freeze painting that hardly moves for sort of two hours. But Peter, I'd say there are flashes of fun. I mean, for example, there's this scene very close to the beginning when Bella first sort of experiences the sort of hypersensitivity of being a vampire, and it's a scene of her sort of running at sort of breakneck speed through the forest, which works really well. And Michael Sheen has sort of one or two very funny little moments as
Michael
well.
Michael Sheen is the Volturi king.
He's the Volturi king.
He's the sort of leader.
Yes.
At one point, he kind of puts out the most bizarre cackle that I've
yes,
ever heard.
I mean,
it's really
very
scary.
Would you, do you want to try and repeat that cackle?
You probably have to cut this. He goes,
yeah! I know, it comes out of nowhere. He goes, ha 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 ha. And then he says, magnifico. And he sounds like he's Kenneth Williams. He sounds like he's gone into some weird vampire Polinari.
It's a tale of teenage longing and abstinence. So presumably, it chimes with the experiences of a lot of its consumers.
Yes, it does. However much teens are sexualized and represented as having great, super cool social life or sex life, actually, most of them, most of us aren't. And it kind of makes that heroic and interesting. Mm. And that's the, I think, part of the secret of Bella and her world-conquering success.
But it chimes in also with middle-aged people who aren't having much sex as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's got that kind of demographic there too.
I mean, there are millions and millions of the silent army, or not-so-silent army, of middle-aged people who are into Twilight and find that it speaks to them. And that's even scarier.
So irritate your eyes at first.
The main thing is not to move too fast.
Try taking a seat, crossing your legs. Maybe a tad slower.
Where the Twilight franchise focused on the undead, Michael Haneke's award-winning Amour simply focuses on the shabby business of dying. Sorry, everyone, there is no happy ending. I can't go on, says Anne, the octogenarian music teacher at the heart of Amour, who suffers a debilitating series of strokes inside her book-lined Paris apartment. Michael Haneke's unblinking, exacting drama rages gloriously against the dying of the light and is beautifully played by both Emmanuel Riva and Jean-Louis Trintignant.
Écoute, arrête ce jeu. C'est pas drôle.
Quel jeu, bon Dieu? Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
Andrew, I was saying that there's no happy ending, but of course the film itself had a happy ending in that it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Oh, little link there. a deserved winner?
I do think it's better than Rust and Bone, which I thought might have won it at the time. I think the thing to say about Amour is that it is a sort of a fantastically meticulous and sort of anti-climactic study of this sort of process. It's just very, very remorseless. It sort of doesn't really use any. I was sort of thinking afterwards about, you know, had this been an American film, even an indie film, you know, there would have been lots of sort of little heartwarming, redemptive sort of tricks and moments to sort of try and get the audience through this. And you know, Haneke just doesn't do anything like that. It's just completely dispassionate, almost documentary in its sort of. In its treatment of this.
One of the most brilliant reviews I read of this film was on Twitter. Brett Easton Ellis, when he came out of it, somewhat stunned, tweeted that it was like On Golden Pond, directed by Hitler. And that's sort of true in a horrible way, much though I admire the film. I think it is an incomparably serious film. The minute it starts, you realise you're in the presence of something kind of old school. I found it like Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage. It's like that. It has an almost unfashionable kind of seriousness and high European sense of cultural importance that is quite alien to other types of cinema and possibly slightly alien to Haneke's earlier work. What is interesting now is the question of, has Haneke slightly softened now? Is this a kind of more recognisably and accessibly human film? Mm. And it sort of is and it sort of isn't.
Andrew, Haneke himself says that he doesn't see this as a political film at all. What's your take on it?
I sort of loved The White Ribbon, his last film, which was much more consciously political and a comment on, you know, sort of social forces at work in the First World War in Germany. And to me, that had the absolute perfect mix of this sort of cinema of torture, yet not so enclosing on itself that a lot of Haneke's earlier films have been. And so, for me, that was a real high point of what he could be doing. And this, I think, to me, steps back a little bit from that. It doesn't seem to have a sort of massive political dimension or social dimension. Not that film has to, but because it's so barricaded, a little airless for me.
Is that true? We're describing it as remorseless and unflinching, and the fact that it's something kind of forbidden to be kind of approached with great caution, which makes it sound like an incredibly hard sell.
I think some people are going to be going to this thinking that it's a very, very upbeat story about the power of love to a lovely old couple who are under death's shadow, and I think people might be find themselves thinking this isn't what I was sold, and I wonder if people are going to think that.
One of your films of the year?
Oh. Goodness, yes. I mean, it's a very remarkable film. It really is.
Emmanuel Riva and Jean-Louis Trintignant in Michael Haneke's Amour there. I think we should now lighten the mood with a little mental illness.
Oh, no.
Mum's gone off again.
Gone off where?
Off her head.
Director PJ Hogan raids the family archives for Mental, his boisterous semi-autobiographical yarn about a family that's bouncing off the walls. Help is at hand, though it comes in the unlikely form of Shaz, a chain-smoking hitchhiker played with gusto by Toni Collette.
I'll make you strong.
Peter, if Amour was on Golden Pond directed by Hitler, this is Shine directed by...
I don't know, Ron Howard? I don't know, something like that. I have very happy memories of PJ Hogan's Muriel's wedding with Toni Collette, and it's fun, great, to see them reunited again. I am a huge fan of Toni Collette. Mm. She is absolutely brilliant in a very unshowy way. And that's a paradoxical thing to say because she usually gives a very showy, kind of high energy performance.
Well, she's this sort of tattooed, chain smoking.
Yeah. She's this
vixen who
complete
comes in.
Badass who comes in. It's a movie which is kind of fun, it's likeable. For the first few minutes, you think it's going to be really good, but then it kind of, I don't know, it settles down to something a little bit more tame.
I like this a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Yeah.
But I still thought that there was a slight problem in tone in terms of. Are we laughing at these people or are we thinking, we mustn't laugh, it's a serious issue. Oh, no, we're laughing at them again.
Yeah,
It kind of veers a little bit. It tries to sort of have it both ways.
It sort of has its cake and eats it. As I say, I thought it was fine as long as it was being completely black comic and mad, as it were, at the very beginning, then it's not at all offensive. Just go for it. Make everybody as mad as a junkyard dog. That's great. But at the end, when it's trying to be a little bit caring, then all this stuff, this semi-serious tongue-in-cheek stuff about mental health issues, that comes close to being a little bit offensive in a way that it wasn't when it was really bad taste at the beginning.
A week ago we were talking about the Sapphires and this is in a similar vein and it's that big candy-coloured, boisterous...
It's kind of Hollywoodized Australian movie-making. PJ Hogan was famously picked up by Hollywood because they saw his natural gift for mainstream feel-good storytelling, and he's still got it. It's still there, but it's part of this Australian thing which we are seeing in the last couple of weeks. That Australian movies don't have to be quite as parochial as we think, but do they have to be as Hollywoodized as all that? Because this is a very different proposition from, say, Animal Kingdom, which was a much more gruelling, tough examination of Australian society. This is mainstream stuff. This is accessible stuff. I haven't got a problem with it.
This wouldn't be happening to me if I had a family of boys.
Boys have breakdowns.
Not Australian boys. They're too busy playing football.
We wrap up with a documentary on the curious second act of the one-time guitar hero, Jason Becker. The Guardian's Elliot Smith sat down with the film's director, Jesse Vile.
Jason Becker is a musician and guitarist, and he is also a very well-known ALS survivor. And so he is a hero to some people, he's an inspiration to some people, and he's the subject of my documentary film. Jason was at the top level. I mean, he was a 19-year-old kid who could do anything he wanted to do on the guitar. He was given the biggest rock guitar gig on the planet and was set to just take over the world of rock guitar. And then a week later, he was diagnosed with motor neuron disease and given 3 to 5 years to live. It just completely robs you of the ability to move, yet your mind and your desire to want to live and express yourself normally and be a normal person carries on. Being the same, so it's literally becoming a prisoner in your own body. Your body becomes a prison. Seeing him kind of just made it all a reality, because he's such a mythical figure. There's so much kind of mystique and mystery and mythology about him. So it was a bit daunting, because it wasn't just meeting him to say hello. I was meeting him to be the person to tell his story.
Then, L, O, low, R, lower, D, N, O, not, T, H, that, not that D. So guitar to computer, and once Jason has his notes on the computer, he has something to work with and play with, and that's like his palette, and he can start to paint his songs.
From Jason and his family, what I learned is that there is hope for people with, a terrible kind of affliction in their lives, whether or not it's a disease or death of a family member or anything. And also, I learned not to kind of sweat the small stuff too much, you know. I think that if I'm having a bad day or something, I just think, well, look at Jason and the hardships he's gone through, and I don't, you know, where do I get off trying to feel sad about something I'm going through when he's still so positive and has found a way to carry on being a happy person.
Andrew, I know you're a big Van Halen fan, so presumably you've known about Jason Becker for decades now.
I have to say, it was the first time I heard of him when I sat down to watch the film. Not a huge Van Halen fan. But I mean, I think the thing to say about this film is it's, you know, a very obviously heart-rending story, which you know is very simply boiled down to the fact that this guy was on the verge of a sort of great, of a good career as a guitarist, not as an Eddie Van Halen level guy, but as a sort of Steve Vai kind of guy, you know, one of these sort of guest guitarist type blokes, and it was obviously taken away from him by this kind of awful disease, Lou Gehrig's disease. From a purely filmmaking point of view, there's some odd things about it. One is the fact that they start off with a shot of Jason as he is now, and then don't come back to him for about an hour in the film. You know, they spend a lot of time talking about 80s hair metal and how great he was. And when the film gets around to talking to him, he proves himself to be a sort of very lively, witty kind of guy.
Peter, it's an inherently moving story about an extraordinary life. Does that make it an extraordinary film?
I'm not sure it makes it an extraordinary film. I think it's good and refreshing that it rescues this kind of story from straightforward route one tragedy. I like the way that it didn't. There's a sort of never say die aspect to the film. It's not a tragedy. The emphasis is on the positive outcome that even though he was, you know, devastatingly diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, and of course it had a devastating effect on his career. Through an extraordinary dedication, he reinvented himself as a composer, effectively. It's odd that the film doesn't say that out loud, but a composer is what he is now.
There's a very poignant moment where he's composing, but he's looking at the guitar that's mounted on the wall that he can no longer play to kind of get the notes in his head.
I mean, I don't know really anything. I mean, I can't judge how good a composer he is or what this kind of what musical presence he has, or is he composing work that other people want to play, for example. But there's no doubt about it. It's good and interesting and kind of remedial for all of us that this narrative has been rescued from grand tragedy.
L-A-D, ladies, A and G-E, gentlemen. T-H-I, this is Jason Becker. T-H-E, the S-E-X, sexiest. M.A. Man Alive.
And so the end is near. It's curtains for us. My thanks to Peter Bradshaw and Andrew Pulver. My thanks to you for being there. The good news is we're back again next week. We're coming straight out of the ashes, and thank heavens for that.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.